on the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur, because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. I hope you're having a great day out there riding the roller coaster life of being an entrepreneur. And thank you so much for being with us today to learn a little bit, perhaps to get your batteries recharged a little bit. We try to offer a little bit of motivation, a little bit of joy to be an entrepreneur. And every day we try to increase that huge mosaic of looking at what it looks like to be an entrepreneur. Every little tiny story we add to the puzzle hopefully will give you an inspiration in a new area, get you started in the right direction. It'll just make your world easier. We have a fantastic show for you today. Brian Eisenberg is with us. He is a persuasion architect. We're going to have a great conversation on AI, especially with Google and AI fighting for that same kind of space. A very interesting conversation. You will enjoy it, I am sure. After that, Lauren Horn is with us. She built a book. It's not exactly like all of the other books. It's much, much, much more. And it became a business, much more than the book. And so it's a fascinating story. And I was so I just thought it was a book at the beginning, and then I saw the book, and then I heard the story, and I was blown away. So we have Lauren Horn with us today to talk about her book, which is called It's Not a Sketchbook. Also, before we get started, I wanted to kind of talk about two markets that we are watching die and learning about. It's kind of fascinating, both industries that we have covered here on the show. First up, Airbnb. I don't know if you can find a positive Airbnb video on the internet right now. Every single thing that you look at is, I am selling all of my Airbnb and getting out of it. And everyone having a negative experience, the users having a negative experience, the owners having a negative experience. And I think it all comes down to what we're seeing everywhere else in the society. At Las Vegas and at our local restaurants, this excessive nickel and diming people instead of just being honest with your price. And I think that's a huge part of the problem. But we've done so many shows on Airbnb, and I'll get an owner on soon, maybe one who's experienced some of the negative side of all of this. But it's as if they don't exist anymore, according to the media. Second marketplace that we are seeing die, and I honestly didn't notice this because I'm not in this marketplace, but marijuana is dying too. A $400 million black hole that could sink Hollywood's elite. I am quoting here from a magazine. Who am I quoting from? I don't know. I don't know this myself, but I found this article. Oh, in the Daily Mail. There's a qualified source. The idea, though, that the entire marijuana industry is crashing because of overregulation and that all the licensed places are going out of business across the world. And so there we have it. Airbnb and marijuana all dying at the same time. Related? That's the question. We'll be back in a second. We are back, and again, thank you so much for being with us. Very excited to welcome Brian Eisenberg back to the show. I don't think he realizes that he's been with us before. He is a persuasion architect. He has for some 30 years or so been helping brands build their stories that they can then sell. He has worked with companies like Google, Disney, GE, Chase, Hewlett-Packard. He is a very frequent keynote speaker and a customer experience and transformation guru, New York Times bestselling author. I love the names of his books. They're fun things like Waiting for Your Cat to Bark, just things like that. They're fun and playful. Been very active in the associations. He was the co-founder and chairman emeritus of the Web Analytics Association and a whole bunch of other things, and then awards as well, Marketing Edge, Rising Star Awards, and quite a few other things. And he's been quoted just about everywhere you can think: Advertising Age, Forrester Research, Jupiter Research, and on and on. Brian, welcome back. You were on the show exactly 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's what I was, that, I was trying to think back, and I was like, yeah, it's been, but it's been a long, long time. The world has changed a lot since then.
Yes, it has. We should dig that interview out and run them back to back and see how that compares. But I think you are our longest guest ever between appearances. So there's an award for that. You are now our winner.
So hey, it's good to start the day with an award. So I'll take it.
Yes, I have to send you a green jacket or something. Anyway, welcome back to the show. In the new book, I never said that. I think I swallowed an elephant. The Stories We Sell and the Success We Build. That's the brand new one. So I should have mentioned it because that's what we're here to promote today. How is the world in the last 10 years? How are the changes that have happened, good or bad? Do you reminisce upon the good old days in the teens?
You know, obviously there's been a lot of change, especially the last few years as AI is coming. I'll say one thing I think really sums it all up. All change is just happening faster, faster and faster, right? I was there at the very early, the internet first breaking out to what I'm seeing today. And, it's harder for businesses. Let's just leave it there.
But there's so many more resources.
There are, but the biggest challenge, and I don't care whether you're the chiropractor on Main Street, the restaurateur, a AI tech startup, Google, NBC Universal, I don't care what company is. I've seen this across the last 30 years. An AI is only going to accelerate the inevitable, and it cannot fix a broken story. And it's like the classic six blind men and the elephant story that you've probably heard growing up, where, you know, each man comes across an elephant and they each touch a different part of the elephant. One of them touches the side and thinks it's a wall. One of them touches the tusk and thinks it's a spear. One of them touches the tail and thinks it's a rope. One touches the trunk and thinks it's a snake. And the challenge is that in so many organizations, the story just gets misaligned. And so the tech guys think one thing, sales thinks another, customer service has another view of them. Meanwhile, the customer, which is the elephant in this case, the big elephant in the room, is confused by the lack of clarity in that story. And AI is just making it worse and worse because more and more noise means less chance to be super clear and get that message across and that experience across crisply.
Yes. But the AI will make us better at that, no? Right?
What AI has done is it's gotten really bad content, at least okay. But the whole premise of AI, when you think about how these models work, is they're predictive engines, right? They're predicting what's going to go next. Have you ever seen great marketing come out of something predictable?
No. No.
There you go. What I found, actually, this is some of my latest research, this has come after the book, is that there are 16 types of stories that businesses need to first sell internally before they start selling to the world.
So we all have to have these 16 pieces?
That's a phenomenal question. No. Companies like Nike and we know they're just brilliant storytellers. They happen to have used all 16 throughout their history. Someone like Adidas has used like 4 or 5. Apple has used 10 or 11.
So these are just different methods to get there with the story?
Correct. And okay. I mean, I know a company I just shared in my keynote in Istanbul, Turkey. And I use them because I think it's a great example. They're an HVAC company, and there's nothing sexy and uniquely remarkable about heating and plumbing and air conditioning. It's just, there's just nothing sexy about it, right? One HVAC guy is the same as the next HVAC guy. But my friend Ken Goodrich built a $100 million business, which he's since sold, based on two of those stories, which is his origin story, which is he grew up holding the flashlight for his dad. And that's the logo. If you look up Gettle Air Conditioning, you'll see that logo. And on his belief stories, what he believed. And one of the key things he believed growing up, for example, was that every air conditioner, you know, every screw needed to be tightened perfectly. And it needed to not rattle or roll in the shroud so that, you know, there was no extra vibrations. And that became belief throughout his organization. But here's the key thing. And a lot of people got this wrong because of Simon Sinek. And he talked about start with why. It's really about your beliefs. If the beliefs cannot be witnessed or experienced by your customers, they don't really count because then it doesn't matter. And so what Ken Goodrich did in his brilliant innovation is he made all his screws shiny and red. So instead of the standard steel or chrome colored, they were red. Then it became obvious to the tech or to the customer if they were replaced and tightened. Simple.
All right. So I was looking at the book and I was thinking, oh, there's 12 or 16 stories. So there'll be 16 chapters and then an introduction out, the 18 chapters in the book. And then I was like, oh, well, apparently there's more. Oh, this list goes on and on. There's 119. Oh, those must be page numbers. And then I was like, nope, those are actually chapter numbers. 119 chapters.
I think it's 120, but I'll have to look why. Yes, it's very interesting. So, you know, I forced a constraint on myself that I didn't want a chapter to be longer than 400 words. So it would take the average person less than a minute and a half to read a chapter.
And that's because of the average bowel movement?
It could be with that. People's attention span today. We live in a TikTok society. It had to be quick. And we have a good friend of ours. We helped him basically increase his business from $25 million a year to $65 million a year before he sold it. And he used to say, you know, I love what you guys talk about. And when we were talking 10 years ago, we had written Waiting for Your Cat to Bark. And it was like 9 books in one. It was just a lot of complex ideas. And we're like, you need to learn how to simplify everything that you say. And so my constraint was, if I can't get across one of these powerful concepts to you in a minute and a half, I didn't do my job. And so that was my actual creative hack in order to make sure I delivered something that anybody could understand and use.
Right. I agree with that. I love that principle. The average person does this? Gladstone or
all the top best-selling books
are 99 written pages long now.
Yeah. And they're written at between a fifth and eighth grade reading level. And
right.
Again, it's just, we don't have time for lots of complex ideas. So if you have a complex idea, you have to learn how to simplify it, because when our brains are so overwhelmed, what works today is clarity and impact. Right. And
yep,
by the way,
I agree. Yes.
The key part to the book was that this is not only working in business, but it works in our lives as well, because part of the book is also about my recent health transformation, where I thought I was over 100 pounds heavier at one point. I was at 277 pounds, got myself to 172 in my 30s. But I did that with the motivation of my keeping up with my young kids as they were growing up. But as you can imagine, kids grow up, and now my youngest is 16, and the other one's in their 20s. And the weight started creeping up, and my health started changing pretty radically. My blood sugar went up into the 300s, and I needed to understand, why. Because it's not like we don't know how to lose weight and be healthy. You know, move a lot, eat well, it's not that difficult. Well, I was moving 9,400 steps. I was eating pretty much plant-based and non-processed foods, but something was still off. And part of the problem was I needed a new story, because the old story about my kids wasn't working for me anymore. I knew it wasn't working for me. I was struggling and lots of other symptoms. And my brother, who's been my business partner for the last 30 years, had 3 bouts of cancer in the last few years. And I was like, I can't be under medication. And I told my practitioner that, give me 3 weeks, let me start changing my habits. And in 4 months, I cleared my whole body up. I got rid of the brain fog. I got rid of the fatigue in the afternoon. I got rid of the aches, the pains, the swelling, the bunion that was painful on my foot every year. It could completely healed to where I have a normal foot. And transformed my life. And for the first time in many years, I had renewed clarity. And that's where the book came from.
And what was the change? I'm sorry if I missed it.
I didn't dare it. So you didn't miss it. It was the story, right? I did not want to be the guy.
You said your story, yes. But what was the...
But the actual physical changes. So yeah. It's tricky.
A couple small
changes. The first one was, I started walking after every meal.
Okay.
So my old habit was I'd wake up in the morning and I'd go for a walk, and then I'd probably eat breakfast and I'd snack during the day and I'd have lunch and all this. And I was just sitting, and throughout the day, my sugar was just accumulating. And then I'd go maybe for another little walk after dinner. I got disciplined. So it's, eat breakfast, go for a walk, eat lunch, go for a walk, eat dinner, go for a walk. Simple. I started prioritizing more protein in my diet. One of the hard parts for me eating plant-based was getting enough protein. I would have to eat too much food, would spike my sugar in order for me to hit that protein. So I prioritized my protein and my fiber numbers. And I started wearing a continuous glucose monitor so I can really fine tune the different things I ate and when I did. And it changed all my behaviors. And like I said, I'm a different human today than I was a year ago.
Well, congratulations. That's great.
Thank you so much. And that's what I love doing for businesses, but I struggle to do it for myself until I fix my broken story.
What's your favorite protein dish?
You know, since I was a little kid, even my grandmother would ask me. No. She'd always ask me, what you want. And they'd ask me this and they'd ask me that. And it always went back to, want eggs? I love eggs. Yeah, eggs are my jam. There's not a day that goes by that I'm not having eggs.
And are those scrambled, or is that a breakfast item, or do you just chug the raw egg like they do in the
No, no, no. I'm not a raw. I'm not that kind of hack that will do the raw eggs. No, I'll scramble them. I'll make an omelet. I'll do fried eggs. I'll do hard boiled eggs. It just depends. I like to vary it up. I don't have to do the same thing every day, but eggs is definitely a protein staple.
All right. The reason I was digging in the book and finding out how many chapters there were was that I wanted to see the list of the 16 stories.
Not in there yet. They're not in there. So those stories came out after the book. Unfortunately, I probably should have maybe waited, but this might be the upcoming book because I just started doing this research recently because I was doing a workshop teaching people how to use those first two stories I told you with Gettle, right? Their belief stories, which is the most fundamental stories that establish trust with your customers. You need to get your beliefs aligned and clear with everybody. Everybody needs those stories. And then your origin story, just like the superheroes have origin stories, we have origin stories. Why did we get into our business? Why we do things? Why do you start this radio show, right? There's a purpose behind that. And people get inspired by purpose. So I was teaching those two stories and I was like, well, if I'm teaching these two stories that sell, how many other story types are there? And as I was doing the research, I discovered that it was these 16, So I started focusing on that. So that's probably maybe a next book. But right now I'm working on finishing up the workshop to teach all 16. I can teach a bunch of them right now, but finishing up the workshop for all 16.
We'll give you another one now, and then we'll move on.
Things like product origin stories, and this is not one for everybody, but if you think about like Dyson, right, or Poo-Pourri, right, why they designed and how they designed their product. And again, it's not for everybody, but that's a different type of story that companies use, right? We know, for example, that, Apple used it when, they came up with the, with the iPod, right? That was another great example of it, or the iPhone. You can also look at stories like, you know, customer stories is another great example, right? Just telling the stories of success that your customers have with your product. It's another type of stories that sell.
All right. I love all of those. I love all of those. I have a speech that's very similar to that, that I have value propositions or elevator pitches. And we have 14 songs that we use that create perfect templates for the value proposition or the elevator pitch.
Oh, I would love to come see you do that some point. That sounds
it's
amazing.
It's online. I'll send you the link. I've done it many a time online. So it's a very similar idea. You know, there's just templates that eventually we can route out, and, you know, well, shock and surprise is one, you know.
Exactly. The thing that I found through all my years is, look, you know, there are people, and this is coming back to the AI, right? What AI is good. If you're a writer, AI can make you a more effective writer, right? If you're a great designer, the things that we can do with AI is going to be remarkable, right? A great coder, it's going to be remarkable what we can do. But people need some of that kind of like paint by number, so that they can take where they are now and get better at it and keep working on their craft. And like I realized, Nike is the ultimate storyteller. We know Apple's been an ultimate storyteller. So if I can start identifying all these types of stories that have been told, people can start understanding, oh, I have these kinds of stories. We can start telling them too. So exactly that. Just trying to give them those templates. And I'm just trying to make sure there's no other like 17th or 18th that I'm missing before I release all of them.
So I, as a small business person, owner, having just heard this, I hope that you are challenged to know what your origin story is and your belief story and your product stories. How, Brian, should I sit down and route this out so that I can clearly explain it? And then how do I use that information, knowing what my origin story is? How does that become an ad?
So there's some great ways to that. So first, before it comes in an ad, it needs to be ingested internally, right? And I found it's even, you know, local friend chiropractor here, you know, some of the people in his office were kind of seeing the way he viewed the world a little differently than the way he did, because they didn't have all his background. And as he's sharing the stories, and we've seen this with the Ritz-Carlton and Nordstrom, how they've created legendary brands around the stories they tell about their values and the reason they exist. And everybody's got to learn how to do that. Once you do that, you can find all kinds of unique ways. Again, we can come back to like the poo-pourri, right? Or the original Dyson ads and how they position their products. They're great ways to do it. Or come back and you can find the Get a We Believe video online. It's another great example of how you can use that. You can put that on your About Us page. And I mean, I've played that for audience across the globe, and people like, I'd hire those guys. Right? Because just the way they're relating. And again, people buy from people. I think that's the most fundamental thing, right? AI can add a little like niceness to it and layer to it and speed to this. But the humanness, that spark that we have, that passion, can't come from anywhere else. And I don't care if you're a business of one or a business of hundreds of thousands.
All right. We only have about a minute or two left, unbelievably. Let me ask you this. So many of our searches are just answered by the AI.
Yeah.
How does Google survive that?
It's a beyond phenomenal question, because we're already starting to see some of the behavior changes. My friend, Dr. Matt Delgado, he's one of the best chiropractors here in Austin. He's been voted by Austin Fit. And what we're finding, and he's seeing these leads come in every day now, people are searching for TMJ Care in Austin, and he's one of two options in ChatGPT. So everybody else who offers TMJ, all the other chiropractors, all the other dentist types, when there's only two options, you're not going to scroll through 30 things. AI does not rank websites like the search engines do. They don't rank it based on your links or authority or, you know, none of that. What matters is what the customers think of your brand, right? We've heard this from Scott Cook, the former CEO of Intuit, Jeff Bezos, right? Your brand is no longer what you say it is, it's what your customers say it is. And that's what ChatGPT is really becoming good at doing, all the AIs are doing. They're aggregating what other people are saying. So from reviews, media, everything you're doing to build a brand outside of just what you want to vomit out on your website, those are things that are impacting people today. So if you're not building a brand that has these, what I call these brandable chunks that are super clear and impactful, like we talked about earlier, you can't win in an AI dominated world.
All right. So answer that question. How do I create something that has that chunk, just as you described, that's going to get AI included?
I'm going to give you one, because you'll appreciate this as someone who spends a lot of time probably in your chair all day long. I'm going to give you one of Dr. Matt's latest ones, because this is one that I had to do also to help my my own health. He often asks his clients, do you know what your AQ is? Because we all know EQ and we all know IQ, but what's your AQ? And your AQ is, how many hours are you sitting on your ASS all day long? And if you got a low AQ because you're sitting on it all day long, you need to raise your AQ. And you know what? People laugh and they share it with other friends. And obviously you can say the whole words, you know, when you're in person, it's a whole different thing. But that stands out. People remember that. And you know what? When they share it on social media, it stands out. When he hands out little timeout prescription cards to people because they need to kind of recuperate, people laugh, they enjoy it, and they talk about him. Do something remarkable every week, and you will create a great brand.
There is a Twitter moment right there. I know that your co-author, is that just the best you could do with your co-author? I mean, aren't you kind of embarrassed?
Well, you know, he's been my brother for a good 55 years, so you know, I'll take him.
Okay. Which one of you is in charge?
So Jeffrey's the older one, so he's more of the CEO type. I'm more of the, you know, the creative and you know, the mouthpiece.
Okay. Are there other kids in the family?
No, but we really could have used one more sibling who's a little bit more detail-oriented, unfortunately. But, yeah, no, we've done well for ourselves, thankfully.
How do we find out more about you, follow you online, get a copy of the latest book, I Think I Swallowed an Elephant?
I'm not hard to find. You could still Google me. You can ask for me in AI. There aren't a lot of Brian Eisenbergs who've been out on, you know, out there for 30 years, and you know, you can check out, you know, many of my books from I Think I Swallowed an Elephant to Be Like Amazon, even a Lemonade Stand Could Do It, to The Rice and Beans Millionaire, Waiting for Your Cat to Bark, Call Back, and there's tons of them. So, and then I'm available on pretty much on every platform. So reach out, ask me a question. I'm happy to answer.
Thank you so much.
And I appreciate you.
I'll be back at you. And we'll be right back. We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. You may remember, you loyal listeners, that I got rejected to architecture school 40 years ago or so and badgered my way in. And the way I did that was the dean gave me a book on trying to teach me how to draw. Apparently, I wasn't a good enough drawer. Artist to get into architecture school. And I learned to draw and I got pretty good at it, but it was a process that I worked on. And eventually I did get into architecture school. And I saw a project recently that reminded me of that story and the book that the dean gave me. And so I was impelled to share this with you. Please welcome Lauren Horn to the show. She was a high school art teacher, and she started posting all of the students' work online. It gained popularity, and that turned into a book, which is called This Is Not a Sketchbook. It's an art class. I think it is a little bit of a sketchbook, too. We're going to hear the story. The cool thing is the students and Miss Horn did this themselves and published the book themselves, and it sold over 10,000 copies, which is enough to make a living on. Lauren, Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us the story. Tell us your version of what happened and how all this got started.
Well, I feel like with so many interesting businesses nowadays, it started during COVID. I got kicked out of my classroom to quarantine. And then when we came back, all my students were so addicted to TikTok and the TikTok dances. So I downloaded TikTok to just kind of have an area to connect with them and had no idea what to post as a 30-something-year-old on TikTok. And so started posting their artwork and their progress, and it really took off. People were really interested. And my message from the beginning, like you said, not everyone is born an artist. Some people have to learn it. It is a skill, not a talent. And the more I posted, the more attention it got. And eventually I started getting demands for people to take my class, but I had a husband who was deployed at the time and young kids. And so I knew I needed a way to take advantage of this opportunity, turn my art course into something that people outside of my classroom could take without much involvement for me. And This Is Not a Sketchbook was born.
Very cool. And thank you for your family's service. I did not know that part of the story. So yeah. Thank you for your husband's service. So how do we use this now? How do you imagine that a user will use the book?
Yeah. So when I was brainstorming, okay, how do I create this art course? I had thought about art courses that I had taken in the back. And I think as an artist and someone with ADHD, I need to visually watch something, but also use my hands. So the sketchbook itself is filled with QR codes that you'll scan, and it will lead you to a video lesson of me teaching you how to do each page. So think about it more like a workbook, but it has pages inside for you to actually draw and do the activity. So you're getting that video, you know, lesson, you're getting some visual response because there's reference photos and everything you need printed in the book itself. And then you're also following along with me as you go through the book. And it takes you from the exact lessons that my students get from day one of class to about halfway through the semester, 9 weeks in, which is really the foundational skills to be able to draw.
Things like perspective and things like that.
Definitely. It's a lot of learning, teaching your brain to see in shapes. I always say you're breaking down what you're visually seeing into puzzle pieces. And this book is going to teach you how to arrange those puzzle pieces back on your page in a way that makes sense. So we talk about perspective. We talk about negative space. We talk about measuring your angles and shapes. And we focus on faces because I do feel like that's the most challenging kind of hurdle for people to draw, is to draw a picture of themselves. But truly the lessons of the book teach you how to draw anything that you can see, whether that's seeing live in front of you or from a reference photo.
Can anyone learn to draw?
100%. I'm a strong believer in it. As long as you have the desire to learn and the willingness to fail, then you can learn to draw.
Willingness to fail, that's outlawed these days, isn't it?
It is. And I think especially in this like high social media, high visibility world, people are having a harder and harder time with it. But if you can break down that barrier of every time I do something, it has to look perfect, then I think that is 100% key. And I've gotten that feedback from my students a lot of, you know, I didn't think I could learn something new like this. And I think that life skill of teaching people that you can kind of fail your way to success, as long as you use every failure as a lesson to grow from.
I have another story, Lauren, to share with you. When I was in second grade, we had an assignment to draw a monster, and I drew a monster with three heads. And my teacher, Mrs. Leeds, criticized it and said, "Jim, everyone knows monsters have two heads." And I learned then that I was not good at drawing and that I wasn't creative, because she told me so.
I hate that this is, I wish that was a surprising story, but I think that happens so often. And people have really terrible experiences in art class that are scarring. I mean, how you said second grade?
Yep.
And I think that really shows what a vulnerability you have to allow yourself to draw, because I think those teachers are hitting us in a moment of vulnerability, which is why we remember that so much more than a math teacher saying, "Hey, you did this problem wrong."
How can we learn to be more creative? How do you deal with creativity and having a whole lot of ideas, I would assume, with ADHD and shiny balls and stuff like that?
I think the biggest it's such a boring tip these days, but be bored. I came up with the whole idea of the sketchbook because I had a 45 minute commute where I would be stuck in my car. And a lot of times I would run out of service from my phone and I couldn't listen to music or podcasts or anything. So I had to sit in silence. And the idea for the book hit me like a meteor. I felt like I kind of knew it was going to be a good idea. But anytime I'm working on my own personal art and I'm really struggling for creative inspiration, I have to put my phone away. I have to go for a walk. I have to let all the, you know, outside stimulus that we're used to go by the wayside so that my brain fills up that space.
Yes, that is good advice. When we talk about creativity lapses, or do you have times when you're just not creative? It's just not there for you. Maybe a whole week, totally, or month or something.
Yeah, totally. I have three little kids. They take about all the energy I can out of me, plus running a business, plus, you know, running a household and all the things that it takes to be a mom. There's times where I'm just totally drained. And I think it's okay to lean into those times sometimes. Your brain needs rest. But when you start getting that itch of, I wish I could create, I think that's also the time that you're really wanting to create. And so allowing you that space and that separation, that's when you know it's time.
I agree with you about being bored. I think it's horrible that children today are never bored. You know,
100%.
I remember going to dinner with my family and the only thing to play with was that placemat with the map of Italy on it. You remember that wood? Are you the paper?
Yeah. Or the sugar packets on a table. I was always sculpting. I mean, that's what it was. Building towers. Yeah. Building towers, setting scenes, making little paper people. And I was lucky enough to have parents that really were very creative in their own right. My dad's very entrepreneurial as well. And he's a painter as well. And they pushed that side of me.
You're very lucky. How do we do that with our children? I guess this book is one way.
Yeah. Yes. And this book is definitely aimed towards, I say 10 and up, because I taught these lessons confidently from middle schoolers all the way up to high schoolers and adults. I'd say most of my customers now are adults. But I do think, again, letting your kids be bored and also kind of being brave about letting your kids be away from you for a little bit. So the world's so scary. We have so much more information. But what I'm trying intentionally to do with my husband is let our kids have time away from us. I read a really interesting study about how kids spend so much time on their phone because they're looking for ways to interact without a parent hovering. And that's kind of their way to kind of sneak off and have their own world. But if we allow them to go run outside more, meet their friends at the park, have a little bit more time away from us, then that's where that not only creativity, but connection happen.
I used to run summer camps for a living and I couldn't agree with you more. Kids need time away from their parents, and these kids that cling to their parents, the parents let that happen. I find that a disservice to the child. So
I agree. And I think it's hard to say the word, you know, you're taking something away from your children by handing them a phone. But I do think you are. You're not allowing them to be bored and they're missing creating those neural pathways. I think so much about teaching art is teaching creative problem solving. And if, as a teacher, I think every teacher in the world will agree with me that that is the biggest thing that's missing from our students' curriculum these days, is you ask them, do you know to solve a problem? And they just kind of look at you and they say, well, how? They want every step handed to them. They're not really used to finding those steps on their own or taking a problem, kind of working it backwards. And I think as soon as you let them be bored, they start to kind of do that on their own. Not to say I've never handed my kid a phone in an emergency when I need to and need them to be still and by my side. It happens to the best of us, but I think being intentional about limiting that and letting kids run a little bit more free and wild is the key.
Yes. Let's talk about a different angle of this story now, Lauren. Talk to me about the entrepreneurialness of this. You did this with, you bootstrapped, right? You didn't borrow any money or anything to do this.
Yep.
And you've made a lot of money, it looks like. Mm-hmm. Walk us through just being an entrepreneur and the business person that's created this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I got really lucky that I had an entrepreneurial family. My father was in oil and gas, but he basically, what he did in oil and gas, he was creating a lot of programs. And they always really encouraged entrepreneurship. And my brother, who is also, he owns his own business and has done a ton of businesses on the side. So I was lucky enough that kind of my brain was wired to look for opportunity and jump on it. And as a teacher, you make so little money. You're almost every teacher I know has some sort of a side hustle. So that again kind of fed that beast of like, how can I make more? How can I make more? And when I caught this idea of I need to make an art course because teaching online is not really working. My kids were waking up. Again, my husband was gone. I was on my own. I had I was a parent friend, so a daycare dad who is a published author. And he sat down with me and basically said, there's no money in publishing. Like, do this yourself. Don't reach out to other people to help you. You can do this. And I already had this big platform on TikTok, and I just kind of like took his advice, knew it was going to be harder, knew I was going to have to learn publishing and printing and marketing and finance and binding and all this crazy stuff. But we have the internet, and the internet taught me everything that I needed to know. I Googled my way through starting this business, and yeah, I've done it all myself with the support of my husband, but it's been me.
Well, amazing job. Congratulations. It was hard to publish this book too, because it has a spiral binder.
Yes.
And this is not just, I mean, this book is beautiful. It is a work of art in and of itself.
Thank you.
Who published it? How did you, I don't mean like the publisher, I mean physically, where did you physically get this book put together?
Yeah, I started in Dallas because I wanted someone who was close. I really was like very particular about, I wanted to make sure it's really nice drawing paper. I wanted to make sure that it looked like a sketchbook that you could buy in stores. So I was kind of afraid to go anywhere international. So I worked with my Dallas printer for a while, but the price per book was almost $14 a book. And eventually I needed to move to outsource. So I use a printing company now in China that I sent them a copy of the book and told them exactly what I wanted, which I think is kind of the reverse. Normally they're sending you samples, but I basically said, you know, how can you recreate this exact thing that I want? And I've been working with them. It's not always easy. It's a little bit problematic. You have a language barrier to work with, and we did have some misprint issues, but ultimately that was the best way to grow my business.
May I ask what they charge?
Yeah, that's fine. I think when I order in about a quantity of 5,000, it's about $1.35 a book.
Wow.
So from huge profit difference.
14 to $1.35.
Yes. And believe me, I searched every American printer I could to try to find something similar to keep me in the US, and it was near impossible. And actually the first round of books that I received from China was during the initial big tariff issue with them. And even paying for all the insane additional tariffs, it was still much more affordable for me to order from China than from the US.
Wow, that's so sad.
It is so sad. I agree. I have we have family history with printers, and it would have been cool to keep it in the family and keep it here. But
how did you find this company in China?
Great question. I had another TikTok friend who she creates, they're called Motherboard Press, and she creates a planner for ADHD people. So I followed her and was interested in that. And then, you know, slowly started looking at her binding and her covers and reached out to her to find out about.
That's another great example of networking, Lauren, that you were able to use that same printer. Very, very impressive. So what is the hardest part of this business been?
It's honestly been so great. I mean, there's definitely challenges for sure. I think just being a one-person business, and I ran into the challenge probably about 6 months ago now where counterfeiters basically photocopied my book and have been selling counterfeits on the internet. And that has been by far the biggest challenge. The logistics of just answering people's questions all day long.
What are you doing about the counterfeiter? How do you fight back? Let the FBI know, and then it disappears into a black hole.
So that's kind of how it started. Was I did all the official channels, and then I contacted lawyers in the DFW area that I thought I could work with. I have a cousin who works as a paralegal at a copyright attorney. She gave me some advice, but ultimately, again, networking on social media, I had a follower of mine tag me in a post of a woman who makes sewing supplies, and she had something similar happen. One of her designs got stolen, and she used this group called Edison. And Edison specifically works in this, is international counterfeits. And so I've been going through that process with them it's a long process, but it's completely free for me. They just take a cut of the profits, and part of what they're going to be doing hopefully soon is they're going to be freezing the account of all these counterfeiters. And then at some point there's a settlement. But to me, I just want these guys out of my way. So
are they
that's
US
my
based or China based?
mostly China-based, but they are all over the world. So Edison specifically only works with non-US clients.
Okay.
Heavy in China, though.
That's a great resource for all of us to know about.
Definitely. They didn't come up in any of my own research, so I was really grateful for that person that connected me.
Yes. How are you able to finance a $5,000 purchase, 5,000 unit purchase? You just have the sales are supporting that?
The sales are supporting that. And I spend very little. I think, you know, from my account, I'm really my only full-time employee. I had a summer intern who was helping me with my social media, who's actually one of the people who took the test class when I was like working out the kinks of the book. She was awesome. And then I have, you know, I just don't pay anyone else besides me. So I have the capital to get inventory, which is really nice. And so much of this is still so new. I left the classroom last school year. So that would have been, you know, August of 24. And that was really the time that I was able to put my full attention. The side hustle had kind of, you know, become the main hustle. And since then, the business has grown exponentially. So I used to have, you know, small amounts in reserve. I'd have to buy inventory, small amount at a time. I was physically driving to Dallas to pick it up on the weekends, storing it at a storage unit here. And now just my business model has changed so much. I'm using fulfillment centers I'm ordering from internationally, and it's showing here. And it's, you know, the profit is there now.
Excellent. Very cool. I had a question and I forgot it.
Can I touch on something you said earlier?
Please.
You said something about networking, and I had a note because I just think it's so important for anyone who wants to be an entrepreneur and want to start a business. I think kind of a huge step for me was to start reaching out to people whose businesses I admire. And a lot of that was women who are about my age and my stage of life in my community who had started businesses. And they were all so willing to help me and so supportive. And I really couldn't have gotten this business off the ground without them. I have a friend who owns a retail shop in the area, and she sat down with me for about 3 hours and helped me set up my website. And I had another entrepreneurial friend who owns like a esthetician's waxing studio, and she walked me through a ton of stuff too. But basically, just by having this community around me and reaching out to all of them and kind of asking them for a little bit of their time, it's really what taught me everything that I needed to know and got me that hands-on experience. There's no way I could have figured out a website in the amount of time that I did without their help. But I just think starting a business, even if you're completely on your own like me, community matters so much. And reaching out to people who are willing to mentor you and to help you along and be there to ask you questions is just incredibly key.
Well, then let's take that the other way. Are you building a community of your users, your buyers? Obviously, you already have the huge TikTok, but are you doing things like, it just jumps to mind, you should have a competition every a couple of years and let people who are using the book, you know, send in their drawings for a $50 prize. And, you know,
totally. I'm not doing as good of a job as I should, for sure. And I did have actually a user say, hey, it would be really fun if we had some sort of online classroom where we could jump in and sort of chat room style.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or sort of. What about a video class? Do you have videos of you doing the entire curriculum?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. And yeah, I think the closest thing I have to that is I'll jump on TikTok or Instagram Live and do a page of the book, and people can jump on and ask questions and kind of jump in with me too. But that's kind of one of those things for me that it's a great idea. It's on the list. But with these little kids that I have right now, you know, it's just going to kind of, some ideas have to wait. Have to
balance things all the time.
Totally.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I can certainly respect that. That is very, very true. Yeah. Are they old enough they can do anything yet? Can they package for you yet?
Yeah, you know what? They're not old enough, but they do it anyways. My 5-year-old loved to package up books with me. He was so helpful. I would get these surges and I would be shocked when I would bring him to my unit. And I used to pack every book with 4 individual corner protectors that you had to fold up to get there. So it was a ton of time. My fingers would be like bleeding and blistered by the end. But my boys were awesome at coming in. My oldest is 8, my middle is 5, and my youngest is 2. So the 2 is, he's a little bit of a toddler burden. But the older 2 are super helpful and great. And I love I don't ever want to separate my kids from the work, because so much of what I'm doing is for them and to create a good life for them. And part of the reason, I mean, a huge part of the reason I left teaching was to pursue the book, but that also gave me the availability to be the field trip mom and drop them off at school every day and not have them in after school care. So I want them to see this side of it. And I think my parents did a really good job with me when they were doing entrepreneurial activities. And I think that that was a big impact on me. I want them to have the same experience.
Very well said. You should also pay them to reduce your income and transfer completely legally money to them for education or anything. And then your taxable revenue for the business goes down. And it's
absolutely, and they're that, helpful
keeping money in the family and to reduce your tax bill and to set up some funds for them.
Yes. And I know that, you know, everyone always says, like, what's the biggest mistake you've made, or what was the challenge? And I think that is my biggest one. What you just spoke to is that basically I was, you know, again, side hustle for so long. And now that I am much more profitable and I do have this, you know, money in the bank, I have basically no idea what to do with it. I've only very recently hired a bookkeeper and hired a CPA to kind of help me out with things like that. But that is like a huge thing that I'm lacking. And I would say probably my biggest entrepreneurial mistake is not doing this earlier, because money is my weak spot. I'm not great at, you know, making sure that my cash flow is doing what it's supposed to do. Basically, in my mind, I was like, as long as the numbers are going up, we're all good. But I'm finally now wrapping my brain around those kind of tricks that we can do.
Well, Lauren, I happen to run a business that does that for you. So I will take the money, and whenever you need any, you can just mail me and I'll send the money to you, and I'll make sure that it's always taken care of for you. How about that?
Wow. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah. I work with a bunch of princes in Nigeria, and we've got this system down. So,
oh, you know what? I think you've emailed me before. I think I've seen that.
That was me. Yes, yes. I also got lost on a beach one time without any of my money, and I might have emailed you then too.
You poor thing. I believe I got that email.
Yes. Lauren Horn, you are impressive. You have done everything absolutely perfectly. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to see
how you continue to grow this with book two and videos and an online community and all the other things that will.
Yeah, I've got some stuff coming out really soon, so keep an eye out.
Excellent. Let me make another suggestion. Hire people in the Philippines to do a lot of stuff for you. They are so cheap and so skilled, and it's by far the best outsource location I have found. If you need help finding someone, I can do that for you. They are amazing. It's just my number one entrepreneurial advice to someone exactly like you. I don't have time. I'm running out of time. Outsource more to the Philippines.
What sort of things do you outsource to them?
Everything. I have now gotten, I'm about 3 years into, maybe 2 years into Frank. And it started off, Frank was 10 hours a week, and now he's full time for me. And he does all of my social media and all of my follow-up and goes through all of my emails before I have to, and answers 90% of them. And I trust him now with everything, and he does stuff without me even knowing about it.
That's amazing. I do need that.
Yes. Yes. So seriously, offline, if you want to talk about that, I can introduce you to that system. Lauren, very cool. How do we find out more about you, get a copy of the book, and learn from you?
Yeah, you can follow me directly on my website. It's thisisnotasketchbook.com. I'm also for sale on Amazon. You just got to keep an eye out for those scammers, but I should be the first listing that pops up. Just make sure you check out the reviews. Make sure you're got the authentic listing, and I'm on TikTok Shop as well. Those are the only three places. So if you Google and I pop up anywhere else, that's not me. You can also follow me at Lauren Horn Art or at thisisnotasketchbook.
Fantastic. Lauren, great story. Thank you so much for sharing it. And we'd love to have you back in a year and get an update.
That would be great. Looking forward to it.
We are out of time. Thanks for being with us. Back tomorrow. Bye now.